Well, as Pastor James said, I'm a Bible college director in Siegen, Germany, and we've been out there for 7 years, and it's been such a joy to do this ministry where I help operate the Bible college there, but I'm also a teacher of classes. But I will tell you this, there's a real frustration teaching Bible college classes, and this is the frustration. Is you're limited by a semester schedule of having to get through a book in a certain number of weeks, right? I mean, when the semester's over, you can't say, well, I just found so much interesting that we never got to the end of the book. You got to finish the book. And it makes you teach through a book, and you have to leave a lot of good things behind. And so just about a week ago, I was teaching at the Bible College, our Monday evening class, and I was teaching through the book of Hebrews, and I was in Hebrews chapter 11. And would you believe I had to cover the entire chapter of Hebrews chapter 11 in one evening. And there was so much that I felt that I had to pass over that it just kind of annoyed me. I wanted more time to go into some of this, and so I thought, I've got the opportunity right now at Stone Mountain to satisfy that itch that's been bothering me and to talk about a little bit greater depth, something from Hebrews chapter 11. Now, this is what I want to talk to you about. I want us to look at verses 17 through 22 this morning. And I find these verses to be filled with surprises. I love that about the Bible. I don't know, for some 30 years I've been studying and teaching the Bible, and it still surprises me. I still find things in the Bible that seemingly I never saw before and are real surprises to me. And we're going to take a look at some of those things together this morning. Okay, so Hebrews chapter 11, starting at verse 17. Now, you know the big context of Hebrews chapter 11, right? This is sort of the museum of faith, right? And the writer to the Hebrews is taking us down the corridors of the museum of faith, and he's showing us, here's the room devoted to Cain and Abel, and here's the hallway of Moses, and here's the room devoted to Abraham, and we're going to take a look at these different heroes of faith through the Old Testament and see what they have to teach us. And so starting at verse 17, he's going to talk to us about the patriarchs, the great fathers of faith, through the Old Testament. That would be Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. How did faith work in the lives of those men? Well, let's start here with verse 17, talking about Abraham. It says, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Now here, the writer of the Hebrews is drawing our attention to something that happened back in Genesis chapter 22. And if I were to ask you what would be a summit peak of faith in the life of Abraham, I think you might pick this very same incident that the writer of the Hebrews is talking about here, right? When Abraham was willing to offer his son as a sacrifice to the Lord there on Mount Moriah. You remember that whole scene, don't you? There's God, he speaks to Abraham, and he says, Abraham, I want you to take your son, your only begotten son, and I want you to offer him to me at the place I'm going to show you. And so right away, Abraham assembles the traveling party that he and Isaac are going to go on. They travel across the place where they need to be, and they get to Mount Moriah, which is today modern day Jerusalem, the same place that Jesus was crucified. They go up on that mountain, and there he is ready to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. And just about when Abraham is ready to plunge that knife into Isaac, God says what? Stop! I'll provide myself a sacrifice. No, don't you worry. I don't want you to offer this human sacrifice unto me. Listen, that willingness of Abraham to stand over his son and to be ready to plunge that knife in his son that would finish him off as a sacrifice, that was faith, wasn't it? Now listen, I used to have my mind wrong about this event. I used to think that Abraham's faith was all about knowing that God was joking all along. You know, that he and God were kind of winking back and forth at each other. God says to Abraham, I want you to offer me your son, your only son, as a sacrifice. And Abraham goes, well, God, I know you really don't want me to do this. We're just going to play act through this. And so I'll act like I'm really going to do it. And then when I get up there, I'll act like I'm going to plunge the knife into my son. But I know you're going to stop me. And God says, yes, Abraham, that's how we're going to do it. And so Abraham stands up there for about 5 minutes over his son, waiting for God to tell him, stop. Come on, God, it's time to tell me stop, right? But that's not what the writer of the Hebrews tells us. The writer to the Hebrews tells us that Abraham was fully willing to plunge that knife into his son Isaac because he believed not that God was going to stop him, but he believed that God would raise Isaac from the dead. And he did it based on absolutely brilliant spiritual logic. Because God had told Abraham this: it's through Isaac that your descendants are going to come. And Abraham knew this, that Isaac had not yet had any children. He was a young man, probably 19, 20, 21 years old, who knows. But he had not yet married, and he had not yet had 4 children. And so Abraham knew this: if my descendants are going to come through Isaac, then there is no way that Isaac can die until he's had at least 1 child, right? Because then the descendants can come forth from that 1 child. But until that 1 child comes, that boy is absolutely indestructible. That was the faith that Abraham had. And so if you were to ask Abraham, "Abraham, you're walking up to Mount Moriah, you're going to offer Isaac your son. How can you give up your son this way?" Abraham would look you back and with a blank stare on his face, he'd say, "I'm not giving up my son. What do you mean? If I kill my son, God will raise him from the dead. I know that he will, because that boy hasn't had any descendants yet, and God will raise up descendants through Isaac. He has promised it." You know what I find very interesting about that? Is that up to this point in the biblical narrative, there has never been a single mention of somebody being raised from the dead. Right? What are we at? In Genesis chapter 22? Never in the Garden of Eden, never up to the time of Noah, never in the early years of Abraham, never up to this time of Genesis chapter 22. Never once do we have a description of somebody being raised from the dead. Yet Abraham, the writer of the Hebrews, tells us, look at it right there, verse 19, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Abraham knew, and he knew without any doubting, that God could raise his son from the dead, even though such a thing had never been done before. Now I understand why the writer of the Hebrews used this incident to hold up before us Abraham as an example of faith, because Abraham believed God. He had faith in God for something entirely new, something that had never happened before. I don't know about you, but that speaks to my heart. There have been times in my life where God has wanted me to trust him for something entirely new. Something that, as far as my life is concerned, he's never done before. And that's exactly what God spoke to Abraham about. I can just imagine Abraham wondering, can God even raise the dead? Is that even possible? It's never happened before. God, can you do this? And Abraham was assured, yes, God can raise the dead. Abraham had faith that believed God for something completely new. I've got to figure that as I speak to this many people on a Sunday morning, there's got to be some people right here now, God speaking to your heart about something that's brand new in your life. And he wants you to trust him for something new. That's a scary thing, isn't it? It's a scary thing to wonder that God might do something new in your life. Abraham is a tremendous example before you of trusting God for something new. Now, when we come to verse 20, we leave Abraham and we come to Isaac. Now, it made perfect sense to me that God would use that dramatic scene of Isaac and Abraham on top of Mount Moriah to be a demonstration of Abraham's faith. For that man, Abraham, who was a friend of God, to me, I regard that as a summit peak of faith right there. But Isaac? Where are you going to find an event of faith in the life of Isaac? Well, Isaac had to trust God many places, didn't he? You know what I think might have been the greatest faith accomplishment that Isaac ever did? Was when he submitted under the knife of his father on the top of Mount Moriah, right? Well, he wasn't a little baby. He was a near-grown man. And his father was an old man, 100 years old. It would have been very easy to say, "Now, father, you're not going to stand over me with a knife to plunge into my chest." He could have pushed the old man away and gone his own way, but he didn't. That was faith for Isaac to submit there. It was faith for him to trust that God would provide a wife for him, miraculously, really, through the guidance that God gave to Abraham and his servant Gehazi. There are many incidences of faith in the life of Isaac, but what's the one that the writer of the Hebrews chooses? Look at it with me right now, verse 20. I think this will surprise you. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Now, do you remember this incident from the Old Testament? Do you remember what actually happened in these chapters? Do you remember what happened when Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau? This was one of the most fleshly scenes that you ever see anywhere in the Bible. Isaac and his wife, Rebecca, had been told by God that of the twin boys that they had, that the younger, named Jacob, would be blessed over the older, named Esau. And that God was going to pass the birthright on to Jacob, not Esau. Did Isaac believe that? No. Isaac wanted to give the birthright not to Jacob, the one whom God said put the birthright to him. He wanted to give the birthright to Esau. And why? For a very highly spiritual reason. He wanted to give the birthright to Esau because he liked the venison that Esau brought home from his hunting trips. Now that's a spiritual reason, isn't it? And so you see, Isaac is totally in the flesh. He's totally going against God's plan. And he says, God, I know that you've highlighted this man or my son Jacob to receive the blessing. I'm not going to give it to Jacob. I'm going to give it to Esau. Well, what's the response of Isaac's wife, Rebecca? Isaac's wife comes back and she says, oh, no, 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 Jacob, we're going to trick your father and you're going to put on some furry clothes because Esau was a very hairy man. And I'm going to cook up some venison and season it just the way that it should. And we're going to deceive your father so that he gives you the blessing. And so what does he do? Jacob goes in there with some kind of hair suit on, with some special food, and he lies through his teeth to his father. He comes to his father and he says, you know, trying to change his voice to sound like Esau's, I'm sure. Well, hello, father. Here I am in for the field. Give me the blessing. And so this father eats some of the food and he gives him the blessing. And Jacob says, oh, good. I've stolen the blessing from his father. Now listen, who was walking in the spirit in this whole occasion? Was it Isaac walking in the spirit? Was it Rebecca walking in the spirit? Was it Jacob walking in the spirit? Was it Esau walking in the spirit? No, every one of them was in the flesh. And yet I read right here, I'm not making it up, verse 20, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. And listen, at first I read this and I said, Lord, I think you've made a mistake in the Bible. I don't see any faith on the part of Isaac in the blessing of Jacob and Esau. And then I went back into my Bible and I read it again and I saw the faith. Are you ready for this? Keep a finger there in Hebrews chapter 11. I want you to turn back all the way back to Genesis chapter 27 and we want to take a look at verse 33. Genesis 27, 33. This is the chapter that describes the whole event of Isaac blessing Jacob and Esau. Okay, you ready for this? Genesis 27, verse 33. Then Isaac trembled exceedingly. Okay, this is after Esau comes in and says, Dad, here I am with the food. Are you ready to bless me? And he realizes that he's been deceived by Jacob and his wife. It says, verse 33, then Isaac trembled exceedingly. By the way, in the original language, it's a very expressive term. It means that somebody's shaking like a leaf. Can you just imagine Isaac there shaking, trembling exceedingly? And look at what he says, verse 33. Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, who? Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came, and I have blessed him. And indeed, he shall be blessed. That was the demonstration of faith. Because right then at that moment, Isaac realized something that I hope you and I can realize, is that you can't outwit God. You can't outfox him. When God says this is how it's going to be, then that's how it's going to be. And even though Isaac, in the fleshly character of his heart, had determined that he was going to pass the birthright onto Esau and not Jacob, God said, oh no, you won't. And I'll arrange things even using the fleshly character of people. I'm going to arrange things so that you end up passing on the birthright to the son that I have intended all along. That birthright is going to go to Jacob and not to Esau. Isaac, I've beaten you at your own game. Verse 33 is the place where Isaac realized that that birthright was going to pass on to Jacob no matter what. When he said those words, and indeed he shall be blessed. Ladies and gentlemen, that birthright wasn't a magic thing, was it? The birthright wasn't the kind of thing where it could be done by deception. Right then, Isaac realized that it was time for him to give up his efforts to try to work around God's plan, and he just had to submit to God's plan by saying, and indeed he shall be blessed. Now, if Abraham had the faith to believe God for something entirely new, Isaac had the faith to give up. He had the faith to surrender to God. Okay, God, I've been trying to work around your plan. No more. I'm just going to surrender to your plan. And I've got to think, speaking to this many people on a Sunday morning in Stone Mountain, that there has to be people here right now. You need the faith from God to give up. You think, well, what faith do you need to give up? It takes a lot of faith to give up to God, doesn't it? It takes a lot of faith to be able to say, no, Lord, I'm not going to try to work around your plan anymore. I'm not going to try to impose my will upon you, God. That's exactly what Isaac was trying to do. He was trying to impose his will upon God, and no more. He said, no, God, I'm going to accept your will, and I am going to recognize that Jacob is the one who will be blessed because you have declared it so. Now, where does that hit your life? You've been struggling against God in some way? You've been trying to work around his plan? You know what his will is for you. Maybe you know what his will is for you in regard to morality. God has spoken. You know what his word says. You know what the right moral thing to do is. And you've just decided in your heart you're going to try to work around that morality. You need the faith from God right now today to give up. To stop trying to work around God's plan, and instead of that, just to simply submit to God's plan. That is what you need faith for today. And you should let Isaac be an example to you. Okay, great. Abraham, Isaac, who's next on our list? Jacob. That's in verse 21. Take a look here, verse 21. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each one of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. Now, do you know much about the life of Jacob from the Old Testament? Jacob, well, I don't know exactly how to put this. Jacob was one of the most carnal, spiritual men ever to walk through the pages of the Bible. That's just who Jacob is. Jacob was not a paragon of spirituality. Jacob was a man who more times than not seemed to be completely ruled by the flesh. He was a deceiver. He was a trickster. He was a con man, both in conning others and in getting conned himself. That's the life of Jacob. Not exactly a spiritual man. I would not have blamed the writer of the Hebrews if he would have completely passed over Jacob when it came to the museum of faith. But instead he mentions him. And how does he mention him? He mentions him at the very end of his life. And here's the scene that's found in the last few chapters of the book of Genesis. Jacob has his sons. They're all in Egypt now because they found a safe refuge there from the famine that's been ravaging that whole part of the world. And Jacob is there with his sons and now leaning upon his staff. Did you see that there in verse 21? Leaning on the top of his staff, he puts a blessing upon each one of his sons. You can find that blessing in the book of Genesis chapter 49, where Jacob passes a blessing on to each one of his sons. And you know what I think is completely remarkable about that? Two things. First of all, he leaned upon his staff. Why did Jacob have to lean upon his staff? Because Jacob needed a cane or a crutch or some kind of support ever since he had a certain run-in with God and where he wrestled with God. And what did God do with Jacob during the wrestling match? He hit Jacob's hip, his thigh, and he dislocated his hip. And the Bible says that ever since that day, Jacob walked with a limp. And I can imagine now in his old advanced years, that hip is arthritic and it hurts and the man can't hardly stand straight. And so there he is leaning on his staff, recognizing that God has gotten the best of him. Every time he'd lean upon that staff, every time he'd put his weight on that crutch, he'd realize, God, you and I had it out, man to man, so to speak, because God appeared to him in a physical form. God, you and I had it out, man to man, and you bested me. You defeated me. Now, friends, don't you see that there's great value in that? Isn't there great value in being defeated by God? In recognizing this, you could say this is the beginning point of all good theology, isn't it? That God is God, and you are not. That's what Jacob came to realize, right? All his life he'd been struggling against God. God, I want you to do it my way. God, I want my fleshly ways, my schemes. Ever since there, he was there at the foot of his father Isaac's bed trying to steal the blessing. All of this, it was his way of asserting the fact that he would be God of his own life until one day an angel came. And I love how the text of the book of Genesis tells us. It says not that Jacob wrestled with the angel. It says that the angel wrestled with Jacob. In other words, who initiated the fight? Who threw the first punch, so to speak? It was God himself. It was as if God came to this man, Jacob, knocked on his door, and he says, you've been struggling with me for a long time. Now it's for me to show you exactly who's in charge, exactly who's greater. Now listen, for the rest of Jacob's day, after that struggle with God, he walked with a limp. Even so here, in his last closing blessing to his sons, he's having to lean upon a staff. And as he does that, he realizes that God has bested me. God is greater than I am. God is God, and I am not. I wonder if everybody here has that first basic principle of theology well in mind. Don't sometimes we think that we're God, that we can sort of direct him along our paths, that it's sort of our job to tell him what to do? No, friends, 1,000 times no. God is God, and the sooner we realize it, the sooner we submit to it, it means that God doesn't have to take us down, so to speak, right? That God doesn't have to wrestle with us until we overcome him. Because let me tell you, Jacob was a more blessed man after God defeated him than in all those years when he was struggling against God. That's the first thing I find remarkable about this. But the second thing I find remarkable about it is the fact that he blessed his sons. And you know what? Jacob had had a hard life, hadn't he? He had had a life where not only he had deceived a lot of people, but he had been deceived and cheated by a lot of people. Do you remember that whole marriage mix-up with Rachel and Leah, right? Where he thought he was marrying one sister, and he woke up the next morning to find out that he had married, well, the uglier sister? And then Laban, the father, says, oh yeah, you know, we never do it in this part of the country that way. We always marry off the older rather than the younger. So if you'll just work another 7 years for me, then you can have Rachel too. Well, he had seen a lot of hardship, a lot of adversity, a lot of trouble in his life. You know, I know people like that, don't you? I know people sometimes through their own doing, sometimes it seems just through the circumstances of life, they've known a lot of hardship in their life. And some of those people that I know who have faced a lot of hardship in their life, it's made them bitter. And the focus of their whole life isn't looking forward to what God has for them and their children. Their whole focus in life is looking backward and being bitter and sour about what has happened in the past. Am I speaking to somebody here this morning who's like that? Maybe that's you. Maybe if you were in the place of Jacob, in your closing days of your life, you would lean upon a staff and you wouldn't look forward to bless your children into the coming days, but rather you'd look back and be sour and grumpy about the hardship or the adversity that you've had to face. I mean, listen, I'm not trying to minimize any of the difficult times that you've had, because I'm sure that there's people here who have had great difficulty, more difficulty than I've had to face in my life. I'm sure if we went through person by person, there'd be stories of people that have cheated you, of jobs that have been lost, of illnesses that have had to been endured, of losses that have had to been suffered. I know it'd be a remarkable story here this morning, but I'm here to tell you that faith says, I'm going to look forward to what God has in front of me. I'm not going to put the focus on what's behind me. That's the kind of faith that Jacob had, leaning upon his staff. He could say, no, Lord, what you have in front of me and in my children, that's where the blessing is. Friends, can I just emphasize that point here for a moment? I don't know what kind of track you feel that your Christian life is upon. Maybe you look back over your life and you feel that in some way you've peaked in your Christian life. And now it's just a time where you just kind of, listen, you're still going to walk with God. You're still going to be a believer. You're not going to come forward and say, I'm going to deny Jesus Christ. Nobody here is talking about that. But you've just sort of accepted that the high point of your Christian life is in the past, and it's not in the future. I'd say, please, friends, take the faith of Jacob. Lean upon a staff, so to speak, and say, no, I'm going to look ahead to what God has for me and for whatever generations come after me. That is the blessing of God. So you see here, I'm surprised. I'm surprised at Abraham's faith, because it was really faith that God would raise Isaac from the dead. I'm surprised at Isaac's faith, because I didn't think there was any faith on that time when Isaac was blessing Jacob and Esau. I'm surprised by Jacob's faith, because he was such a carnal, unspiritual man. I'm surprised that there was any faith in his life. But then finally, in verse 22, we come to Joseph. Now, Joseph is an interesting character, isn't he? Was there faith in the life of Joseph? Oh, yes, there was faith in the life of Joseph. And if you were to pick out a shining example of faith in the life of Joseph, what would you pick? You'd probably say, well, Joseph had the faith to speak forward the dreams that God had given him. That's faith, isn't it? You might say, Joseph had the faith to believe God that even though he was sold as a slave into Egypt, that God would still use him. Joseph had the faith to endure prison. Joseph had the faith to resist temptation. Joseph had the faith to go forward and to interpret that dream of Pharaoh. Joseph had the faith to act on that dream. Or you could say, Joseph had the faith, this is a big one, isn't it, to forgive his brothers. I could think of probably a dozen examples of great faith in the life of Joseph. And which one of those examples that I've just mentioned to you does the writer of the Hebrews use to put forward Joseph as an example to us as a great man of faith? Not a single one of them. And again, sometimes I read this and I think, you got it wrong, God. You picked the wrong example of faith from the life of Joseph. But of course, God gets nothing wrong. So are you ready for this? Are you ready to be surprised? What's the great achievement of faith in the life of Joseph that the writer of the Hebrews points out to us? Let's look at verse 22 together now. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instruction concerning his bones. What? What's that talking about? You just kind of ask yourself, Lord, did you really say that right? This is the example of faith from the life of Joseph that you want us to pay attention to. And God would say, absolutely it is. Do you know what this is all about? See, Joseph, in the last years of his life, he knew that he was going to die. And he knew that he did not want his body to be buried in Egypt. No, he wasn't an Egyptian. He was a Hebrew. He belonged in the promised land. But neither did he want his body to be taken away into the promised land right away after he died, as was the case with Jacob. Jacob said, when I die, you take my body back to Canaan, back to the promised land, and you bury it there. Joseph said, no, when I die, you leave my body in Egypt until the children of Israel leave Egypt and collectively head back to the promised land. Now, when do you think that was going to happen? 20 years? 40 years? 80 years? How about this? 400 years after the time of Joseph. And by the way, I believe that Joseph knew it was going to be 400 years because God told Abraham that it was going to be 400 years that the children of Israel would be in Egypt. And I believe Abraham told Isaac, and I believe Isaac told Jacob, and I believe that Jacob told all of his sons. I think Joseph knew my body, my sarcophagus, is going to remain right there in Egypt for about 400 years until the promise is fulfilled and the children of Israel leave Egypt and go back to the promised land. Ladies and gentlemen, do you have the faith to believe God for a promise that's going to happen 400 years after your death? That's faith. And not only that, he wanted his body to be a testimony to every person descended from the children of Israel who lived in Egypt up until that time that they were not Egyptians and that they were heading back to the promised land. I'll tell you how I have it in my mind, and I'm not saying that this is how it happened, but this is how my strange mind puts things together. I envision a school trip of little Jewish children, Hebrew children, there in Egypt. They're off on their little class trip to the museum, and they go through all the museum, and their school teacher says, "Okay, children, finally, we've got the sarcophagus of Joseph." And they all look and they go, "Ooh, the sarcophagus of Joseph. Joseph is there." And they say, "Well, why isn't it buried?" And the teacher says, "Because Joseph didn't want it to be buried. Joseph wanted his body to proclaim the truth that he was going nowhere until all the children of Israel came out of Egypt and back to the promised land." I find that to be remarkable. Joseph, that had faith, that believed God's promise even more than Jacob did. Jacob, who demanded that he be buried right away in Canaan. Joseph said, "No, I know that that promise is going to be 400 years in fulfillment, but I know that it's going to happen." Have you ever noticed that sometimes the promise of God in your life takes an excruciatingly long time to fulfill? Some of you worried about that. Some of you have children. You're very burdened for your children. Those children aren't walking with the Lord right now. They're in rebellion in some way or another. And you feel that God has spoken to your heart a promise that your children will come back and really be walking with the Lord the way that they should. And their life will be ordered under God's plan the way that it should be. And that promise seems so hard to believe right now. I ask you, is it any harder to believe that than to believe that 400 years in the future, God's going to fulfill his promise? You can believe that. You can believe it. Even though sometimes God's promise takes much longer and it's much more difficult than we ever, ever believed before. And I think, yes, yes, Lord, you knew exactly what you were doing when you wrote this down in the book of Hebrews. You knew exactly what you were doing when you said that this is a shining example of faith in the life of Joseph. That Joseph was a man who could stand before the people of God. And he says, "I don't care if it looks like we're never leaving Egypt. We are. And our home is Canaan. It's not Egypt. And my body never being buried will be a testimony of that up until the very end." As I look back, all four of these, I get astounded. I think, yes, Lord, there's faith exemplified in Abraham. Faith that could believe God for something brand new. There's faith exemplified in Isaac. Faith to give up and let God be God. There's faith exemplified in the life of Jacob. That's faith to look ahead and to not behind. And finally, Joseph exemplified for us faith that will believe God's promise no matter what. And let me tell you the greatest promise from God that you can believe no matter what. And that's simply the promise that God makes to you that he'll forgive your sins because of what Jesus Christ did on the cross. There's some of you, you struggle with that. Because you know, maybe nobody else knows, but you know what kind of sinner you are and what kind of sinner you've been. You're hoping people don't find out the depths of your sin. And I'm here to tell you that if you'll turn your faith towards Jesus Christ, if you will believe his promise no matter what, the greatest promise you can believe is that Jesus Christ died on the cross, taking the wrath of God the Father that your sin and my sin deserves, and he took all the guilt, all the punishment, all the wrath, all the shame that your sin and my sin deserves, he took that upon his own self on the cross. You know, sometimes the greatest promise that people have a hard time believing is simply the promise that they are forgiven. Well, you can be. God promises it so. He promises that if you'll put your faith in the work that the Son of God did on the cross for you, then you'll be forgiven. That is not a promise too big for you to believe. And you can say, no, Lord, I'm going to let Joseph be a pattern of faith to me. I'm going to believe your promise no matter what. And Father, that's my prayer for all of us this morning. Lord, you make promises to us in your great and holy word. Promises that honestly, Lord, seem beyond our comprehension. They're certainly beyond what we deserve. And so we ask, Lord God, that you would simply shine the light of your Holy Spirit upon us to give us the ability and the strength to believe your promise. And this morning in particular, God, we want to turn our focus of the promise of what Jesus Christ did for us on the cross. I pray that not a single person here would feel that they are beyond forgiveness, that they're beyond the cleansing that the cross offers, and that they would put their heart, their mind, their soul, looking to what Jesus did for them on the cross and not what they might intend to do for themselves. Do it, Lord. And thank you for these marvelous examples of faith. In Jesus' name, amen.